You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're here today at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, home of one of the largest veterinary schools in the country. And when you hear the word veterinarian, most of us probably think of the person who gives our dog or cat or a rabies shot. Well, vets do that, of course, but they also do a lot more. But how would you know that? Have you ever sat down and talked to one of vet? And to a vet about what he or she actually does? Well, that's what we're going to be doing this hour, and you'll have an opportunity to interview a vet or to talk to a vet. They do lots of different things. We're here in the Cornell's Bailey Hall, and I invite you to step up to the microphones if you want to ask a question. Also, you can call us at 1-800-989-8255, and you can also tweet us at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI. With that taken care of, I want to get to talking to the vets, because this is something that I've wanted to talk a lot. I used to have a dog and never had a chance to talk to the vets about what they do. And when I was growing up and going to college and talking to all my med student friends, I said, "Do you ever think about being a vet?" They said, "Oh, that's much more difficult. Much more difficult than being a family doctor, being a vet." And we'll talk about why that is. Let me introduce my vets on the side here. Tom Gill is a large animal veterinarian and owner of the Brookside Veterinary Clinic in Auburn. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Gill.
My pleasure.
Lisa Fortier is president of the International Cartilage Repair Society and associate professor of large animal surgery at Cornell University. Thank you for being with us, Dr.
Thank
Fortier.
You.
Sarah Mikesell is a small animal veterinarian and the owner of Veterinary Care of Ithaca. She's with us.
Thank you.
And Alfonso Torres is Associate Dean for Public Policy at Cornell University. And actually, he was the first national vet. Would that be sort of like the Surgeon General for Veterinarians, the first one in this country?
Without the fancy uniform, yes.
Without the fancy uniform. Well, while I'm talking to you about that, you sent me a note about an interesting story about the first chief veterinary officer. An interesting story behind that. Share that with everybody.
Yes, Cornell Veterinary College is the oldest educational program in the United States. We graduated the first person with a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine degree in 1872, not far from where we're sitting here. And that individual was named Daniel E. Salmon. Dr. Salmon became the first veterinarian working for the then newly created Department of Agriculture. And working with a swine disease, he discovered a family of bacteria that is named after him, Salmonellas. So every time that people hear about Salmonella, we want to think about veterinarians, think about Cornell, think about what we do in public health.
Wow, Dr. Salmon, Salmonella, wow. Learn something new every day. Let's learn something new about what vets do, because that's a fascinating story. And let me begin with Dr. Mike. So you're the type of vet that most of us are familiar with, bring their pet into the vet's office. Your dog or your cat, how do you know what's wrong with the animals?
A huge part of what we do is listening to the owners. The owners live with these animals every day, and they can see really small changes in their behavior, what they're doing at home, that make a big difference in what I look for and what I find. And a physical exam is very important as well. We mm-hmm. perform very thorough physical exams. And we do a lot of the same kinds of things that medical doctors do, human medical doctors. We do x-rays, ultrasounds, blood work.
And how new is that? I mean, when I was a kid, we didn't have any of those things.
They were available, just probably not generally used by most, you know.
So the practice has changed. Your human patients are demanding more?
Absolutely. They look for much better veterinary care. When I started veterinary medicine practicing 28 years ago, dogs were dogs that you just shoved out the door to go to the bathroom in the morning and, you know, brought in at night or kept outside, and now dogs are members of people's families. And so are cats, and so are a lot of rabbits, gerbils,
hamsters. Yeah, designer food and designer clothing.
Absolutely.
Things like that. Tom, I know your practice treats small and large animals, but mostly a large animal vet. How's that different than the patient that she has?
You know, there are several similarities, because I concentrate a lot in dairy medicine, and so we're seeing dairy cattle. Just like Sarah just mentioned, on an individual patient basis, It's real important to find out from the dairy producer, from the farmer, a good history, what's going on with that particular cow. She's off feed. How long has it been since she had a calf, et cetera. But the other side of things, on the dairy side at least, is that we practice sort of a population medicine. And so we look at individuals, but we also look at the herd. And so there are some other things that we keep track of that are important to the quality of your food, certain metrics on the farm that we follow just to make sure that the herd itself is healthy. So at least in the dairy business, it's sort of a combination between individual patient care, which is very similar to what Sarah was just talking about, and then also following the herd overall health.
But you may be following a herd of cattle. But if someone has a sick llama, they're going to call you up also, aren't
exactly,
they?
Exactly, exactly. But then I would turf that to one of my associates because, I've practiced on some llamas and alpacas. One of the beautiful things about veterinary medicine, I think, is that it is a multi-species kind of business. And if I had to get up and do the same thing every day of my life, I would probably go a little crazy. So it's nice to be able to do a few different things on different species. However, it is difficult to be real specialized in everything. So we primarily treat horses, but mainly backyard horses, broodmare, racetrack kind of stuff. Primarily dairy, because we're in a great dairy county in Cayuga County. And then we do, now we're seeing more and more of the alpacas and llamas.
Right, right. But Lisa Fortier, you treat the high-end horses, right? Dr. Fortier, you see the good racehorses that he doesn't get to see.
For the most part, the animals that come to see me, I'm a surgeon by training, so the animals that come to see me are specifically referred by people like Dr. Gill for a surgical procedure.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of surgery do you do on these horses?
I do a lot of biological transplantation, so we focus mostly on cartilage repair to prevent joint replacement and a lot of tendon surgery as well.
And you do cutting-edge surgery that can't be performed even on people, yeah, don't you?
That is correct. We're not limited currently by FDA standards, so the horses are a great model. If we can get something to work in a thoroughbred racehorse, then perhaps the Chicago Bulls can be treated with it as well.
No pun intended on that one. What kinds of stuff, for example, would it be stem cell research, something like that?
Stem cells are a great example. Another one is a highly used biologic called platelet-rich plasma. So you take your own blood and you isolate out the cells that are responsible for clotting your blood called the platelets. And the beauty of the platelets are that they are your reservoir of your growth factors. So we have studies on cartilage and in tendon looking at the efficacy of platelet-rich plasma for regeneration.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that if you can get this to work in a horse, and the horses, these are expensive horses, right? And so their owners are not going to take a lot of chances with them. They have to be pretty sure that something might yield a result. If you can get them, that is sort of a pioneering step to possibly working in people.
That's correct. And not only do they have to go back to performance, these racehorses are really high-end athletes. They're elite athletes.
Mm-hmm. And how long does it take a treatment like this to take effect? And does it really repair the joints that you're talking about?
It depends on the extent of injury. It will not repair full arthritis just yet. It's more for traumatic lesions. And in tendons, it still takes some time for the body to repair it. What we're seeing is that we can get the horse back to performance faster, and they're much less prone to re-injury.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Dr. Torres, does the chief veterinary officer mostly deal with animal diseases that would cause problems for the rest of the country? What is that job?
Yes, that is correct. There is a number of diseases that, for example, we do not have in the United States that are what we will call catastrophic livestock diseases, that if they were to come into our country, not only will devastate our population, but also will damage our economy. So the chief veterinary officer of any country deals with how to prevent those introductions, and if the introduction comes into place, how you control and eradicate that disease.
Mm. So you'd be watching for stuff that maybe came in from Canada or Mexico or any other imported.
Or now with globalization, could come from any place. We still don't know, for example, where West Nile came from in those years. So now with global warming, we have more movement and persistence of certain arthropods that are vectors of many of these diseases as well. So,
is there a good reporting system available for people when they see this, other veterinarians see this, that they report
There is an international organization called the World Organization for Animal Health, and all member countries, about 174 member countries, need to report the occurrence of these diseases within 24 hours, and that information is broadcast to all country members. So the whole world is watching for the emergence or movement of these diseases.
What was the last bad one that struck?
Well, the last bad one in the United States was probably Newcastle disease in California in 2003.
What is that?
That is a disease that affects all birds, but primarily commercial flocks, chickens, and so forth. And they caused about the destruction of about 6 million birds before the disease was under control. And that came because of smuggled game cocks from Mexico.
Would you be seeing swine flu moving around? Avian flu carried by birds moving around as well as swine flu.
That is one of the concerns, that diseases like avian flu could be moved with migratory birds, except that the most poultry industry has a very good biosecurity, very good physical separation between the commercial flocks and the migratory birds. So the chances of that happening in a commercial flock is unlikely, but it could happen more in a backyard hobby type of farm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see cases of these unusual cases, or are you just basically taking care of the aches and pains of the cows? And
well, you know, one thing I would say, you mentioned reporting. Most states, especially New York State, practitioners that are in the field doing especially food animal medicine are members of they're accredited by the state to cooperate with regular state veterinarians who are in charge of keeping our livestock and our public health healthy. So as a private practitioner, you know, it is my responsibility that if I see strange diseases or symptoms that may be similar to some of these zoonotic diseases, diseases that can affect people and animals, or especially diseases that can affect our agriculture, to report those.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back lots more here to Cornell and talk about animal health and with the vets. So here's your question to ask a vet. 1-800-989-8255. Step up to the mic in the audience here in Bailey Hall in Cornell and Ithaca. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about what it's like to be a veterinarian with my guest, Tom Gill, a large animal veterinarian and owner of Brookside Veterinary Clinic in Auburn, New York. Lisa Fortier is president of the International Cartilage Repair Society, associate professor of large animal surgery at Cornell. Sarah Meixel is a small animal veterinarian and owner of Veterinary Care of Ithaca. Alfonso Torres is associate dean for public policy at Cornell University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's start right over here. Yes, step up to the mic.
Have any of you ever worked on any insects?
I think that's one of the more unusual questions we've had. Insect, animal, are insects animals? Small animals.
I've been bitten by a lot of them, I guess. But
that's a serious question.
You know, there are some parasites that affect some of our animal patients. Cattle get a kind of a grub, actually, called Hypoderma bovis that is sort of gross and you would probably think was pretty cool. It comes out of underneath their skin like a big pimple, and it pops out, and it's a big, thick, fat, chubby larva that then completes its life cycle and turns into a fly. So that's probably
close.
We usually step on those insects. We don't we don't treat them, but...
All right, let me go. Dr. Torres, you wanted to jump in on that one.
Yes, actually, in all countries except the United States, diseases of bees and other insects are under the supervision of veterinarians. And
is that right?
And there are significant bee diseases that can affect the economy of the country that are also part of these reportable diseases. But in the United States, bee diseases are handled under the plant pathologies because of the associated with plants.
So, would you like to see that changed?
Well, it would be interesting. It would be another species we have to learn about.
Right. Yes, sir.
Hello, I'm from Buffalo, New York. I operate a low-level laser clinic for humans. And I wanted to see if they had any experience with this new technology. I actually saved a horse's life using this technology, a horse who had a severe laceration that wanted to put the horse down. one procedure with this laser, and the animal was out of pain and healed in a matter of a couple of days. So I'm assuming they must have looked into this or are using this technology now. I'd be interested.
What part of the body are we talking about?
Lacerated his right below his knee.
Right, Dr. Fortier, right in your ballpark. Yeah.
Yes. There's a tremendous number of adjunctive therapies, such as lasers, that are used quite commonly in horses and in people. Some of them have great clinical evidence to support their use. In horses, there's not a great amount of literature to support the use of lasers, but there are many, many single case reports like you're describing.
Thank you. If I were to go into your surgery lab, where you do your surgery in your operating room, would it look like a place that a human might be having surgery? You have a nurse, assistants, you know, anesthesiologists, things like that.
It looks exactly like that. I think the biggest difference is that, one, it's all women. So usually the anesthesiologist, the anesthesia resident, the student, me, the nurse, it's women across the board. So that's a little bit different, especially in orthopedics.
Because?
Because something like 85% of the veterinary classes are women. And still, and it's probably close to that in human medicine as well, but in orthopedics it's still a male-dominated field. So it looks exactly like that. When we do have human surgeons come from Hospital for Special Surgery, we do a lot of collaborative work with them on animal model diseases. Mm. And their biggest comment is that, you know, if you were going to get operated, I'd say, okay, jump up here and then inhale this gas three times and you're going to go to sleep. To put a horse under anesthesia, it takes five or six people. It's very, very labor intensive to put them under anesthesia and then hoist them up and get them onto the table. So it's more the labor, but the equipment for the anesthesia, the equipment for the surgery, the techniques are all identical.
Now, Dr. Gill, when you go out to the farm and work on a cow, same thing happens, right?
Well, actually, we do perform several types of surgeries on cows.
Have they big clean room? You bring the cow into the operating
I'm usually
theater?
Swatting flies, trying to keep them out of my incision, actually.
So they're not coming to your office?
Nope. If we they are somewhat limited, but we do abdominal surgery. We do C-sections on the farm. I'll tell you, it is a little bit like medicine must have been back in the in the 1800s, I guess, because if I have a C-section, for instance, what will happen is I will pick one of the farm hands who's willing to help. I'll show him how to scrub. I'll put his gloves on. I'll tell him not to touch anything until I tell him, and we prep the cow, and away we go.
There in the barn.
Though. Right there in the barn. Set up a straw bale for our surgery table, and... If we're fortunate, we may have enough light. If we're not, then we just go.
That's because your cow is more of a commodity.
Thing, too, there are veterinary large animal veterinary clinics in the country where they will truck in cows. Obviously, Cornell has a great facility for trucking in dairy cattle. And if it's something more, if it's an intestinal surgery or something that I think needs to be have a little more. A little more skill, we'll refer those to Cornell. But the thing is, dairy producers are busy folks. They've got a lot on their plate. They do have to keep their costs down, and it's doable. The cows do extremely well in the barn situation. You know, if it's the middle of winter, it gets pretty chilly. If you got to have your sleeves taken off. If it's the middle of summer, you try to keep the sweat from dripping into your incision.
I saw a photo. Our producer, Annette Heiss, was out of your farm. I was out of the farm with you.
Right.
And she came back with some photos with your arm in the cow all the way up to your armpits. What were you doing in that picture?
Well, actually, there's laws against that. I'm not sure I should... No. A big part of what we do in the dairy business is... cows, like any mammal, they start to lactate. They produce milk after they've had a baby. So a cow has to have a calf in order to make milk. And so financially, it's very, very important for the producer to get these cows bred and then rebred after they've calved. And so we go out on a regular basis and do reproductive exams on the cattle, diagnose pregnancies, and when cattle are not pregnant, try to figure out why they're not getting pregnant.
It's your palpating.
So we're actually I'm actually doing a palpation of the cervix, the uterus, the ovaries. We can even guesstimate somewhat what the structures on the ovaries are. We do also, for many of our herds, use ultrasound, so we can actually see. It's a probe we take right in with us.
Right.
But Very clean work.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures. Like the Maxell sounds just like what you would be doing in your small animal pet laboratory or your pet veterinary office. Do you do anything like that at all?
No. I think a lot of people in the audience have taken animals to veterinarians, at least their pets from home, and so, you know.
It's not cheap now to do any of these surgeries on animals, is it?
It's not, because owners expect good care for their animals. They expect high-quality care, and high-quality care is expensive.
Mm-hmm. Is there pet insurance?
There is.
Mm-hmm. And is it like they're going through the same debate we're having with human health care insurance?
No, not quite. I've always counseled people that, you know, pet insurance can be good if something catastrophic or a major illness is going to happen. You've got it there. If your animal's going to be healthy, then you don't necessarily need it.
Do you at all, any of you, get involved with your patients? I mean, you have to keep really unpersonal, right?
It's hard. It's hard. You know, you take care of a puppy or a kitten from the time it's really young until they're dying of cancer at age 15, and you're in the room with the owner, when you're performing euthanasia.
Dr. Fortier, now I'm going to have a senior moment and blank on that famous racehorse who spent a year, who broke down at the Kentucky Derby.
Barbaro.
Did that change the nature of your work at all, what you're expected to do, or people have expectations about surgery?
Most people, after Barbaro was put down, want to know that their horse is not going to end up like Barbaro, and you just can't obviously guarantee that.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go here, and then we'll come on this side. Yes.
Hi, my name is Diego Ray. I'm a PhD student here at Cornell, and also working on a startup called GeneWeave Biosciences for detecting toxic and drug-resistant bacteria like MRSA. And I was curious, what are the most serious bacteria that you guys as vets encounter, both in terms of livestock as well as domestic animals?
Well, Dr. Torres mentioned Salmonella. When I'm on a farm, if I have suspicious cases of Salmonella, I mean that's one of them. Because, you got to remember, on some of our farms, some of these folks still drink the milk directly from their bulk tank. It's not advisable, but some of them do, farm families, and so I'm concerned about their immediate health as well as the food quality to the rest of us. There are a lot of species-specific species-specific viruses. You mentioned bacteria.
What about MRSA? Can your animal give you MRSA? At least I see you're shaking your head.
It's much more common in a hospital setting, a MRSA. It's one of the things we have MRSA committees for.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah, can your dog or cat, is it a good idea to have them to sleep in your bed with you at night? Because they're going to be bringing a lot of this stuff in with them.
Well, as she said, in the hospital setting, MRSA and things like that are a lot more serious problems. In most, pet owner situations, it's not as serious, although it's certainly a consideration. A lot of people have their pets sleep with them at night, and most of the time it's safe.
And once they start sleeping with you?
They're not going to stop.
I learned that from a vet years ago. Once they start, you're not going to break them.
That's right.
Of that. There's the lesson for today. Yes, over here.
Yeah, foods are chemicals, and some foods are poisonous to dogs. We all know chocolate is very toxic to dogs. Are there other ones that we're not aware of that we might be feeding our pets that could hurt them?
Go ahead, Dr. Mikesell.
There are. One of the big ones that we've learned about relatively recently are grapes and raisins. There is an idiosyncratic reaction in certain dogs, which means that not every dog will have a problem from grapes or raisins, but dogs who do get very seriously ill with kidney failure, and it can sometimes be fatal if not caught early. So, yes, in addition to chocolate, grapes and raisins, onions, garlic, a number of things.
Can your pet live a wonderful, normal, healthy life without buying all these high-end dog and cat foods, the designer foods?
It can. there are a lot of good foods on the market, and not all of them are the high-end foods. But in my opinion, you're still better off feeding a commercial food, although there are many good recipes out there for home-cooked diets as well.
Mm. And table scraps?
Table scraps are fine as long as you're not feeding them the wrong foods or feeding them too much of them.
Uh-huh. Dr. Torres, as important as vets are to our food supply, I've read several reports of a large animal vet shortage. Is a large animal vet shortage in many parts of the country? including here in New York State. Is that because, as I said before, my friends who are MDs say, I don't want to be a vet. It's too hard to do that. Is that part of the reason?
Yes, it's a multifactorial reason. One is we have only 28 veterinary colleges in the United States. Mm-hmm. So we have way less number than medical colleges, for example. Then the output is about 2,500 veterinarians per year, but the demand is outgrowing that. Also, most students graduate with a huge debt, about $80,000 to $100,000 in student loans, before they complete 4 years of baccalaureate degree and then 4 years of veterinary education. So many of them elect to go into a small animal practice that is a little bit more profitable than going to large animal practice. Mm-hmm. And so there is a shortage of large animal veterinarians, and as you say, particularly in New York, to the point that we have authorized Canadian veterinarians to come into the upper tier counties and practice veterinary medicine in New York.
Mm-hmm. Talking about veterinarians this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. Here at Cornell University in Ithaca with one of the country's most famous veterinary schools and colleges. Tom, do you want to follow up with that? Is it tough to become a vet?
Yeah, I agree with Alfonso. It is a very complicated issue. One of the problems is that it's a very demanding job in the sense that you are responsible for covering emergency work. A lot of our small animal clinics have now been able to, because people are expecting a higher level of care, now a lot of those emergencies are going to veterinary emergency clinics. But in the case of large animals, equine lacerations, colics, cows that are having calving problems, et cetera, I mean, we have to go to them. And so it is one of the more demanding kind of jobs.
How do you learn all the different body parts of different animals? Carnegie Hall answer.
One of the beautiful things I think about veterinary medicine, and even though it's a demanding, I'd encourage all young folks to just because you haven't been raised on a farm, you should really look into if you're interested in veterinary medicine, consider food animal practice or large animal practice. But one of the beautiful things about veterinary medicine is a very comparative study of species. These MDs, they go to school and they learn everything about one species, that's us. Fortunately, there are very, very many similarities, anatomical similarities, physiologic similarities that cross species. But then you have to just learn the exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the audience here. Yes.
Yes, I have a question about Lyme disease and that it's not recognized by some doctors or the treatment is controversial. And I was wondering what kind of research is being done in animals and if there is any political or controversial treatments for animals as well.
Dr. Torres, you want to pick up that hot potato?
I'm not a clinician, so I'll let my colleagues to talk about the treatment, but there are cases of Lyme disease, not only in dogs, but also in horses. So we have used those as an example of how you can understand the cycle of the disease in the animal, the vector, which is a tick, the reservoir, which could be the deer mice, and then the intermediate vector of the deer. So it's a very complex set of circumstances. And in those cases, we veterinarians need to work with entomologists and ecologists to really understand all the cycle of these diseases transmitted by arthropods. But it is a disease that is important for some of the clinical practices. So perhaps
Dr. Fortier?
Yeah.
I think some of the reason it's controversial is that in horses and in people and in dogs, the primary clinical sign is supposed to be not moving well or some generalized pain. So it's a common complaint of performance horses to say, my horse isn't going quite right. And Lyme disease is very difficult to diagnose. So you can get joint fluid and blood and all kinds of different things. And the truth is it's not black and white at all. There's many gray scales to say, yay or nay, your horse has this or dog has this disease. And the treatment, I don't think, is controversial in that it's treated with a tetracycline antibiotic. But the tetracycline antibiotics, like all drugs, have alternate side effects. And that they're very potent pain relievers as well. So you bring your horse to me, you say, I think it has Lyme disease. I treat it with doxycycline, but all the tests say it's negative. But you say, well, you're wrong because it got better. But it maybe got better because of the side effects of the drug, not because we killed the Lyme disease itself.
There you go. We're going to have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more about being a vet. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, twittering at SciFry, here at Cornell University in Ithaca at Bailey Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, and we are talking this hour about what veterinarians do with a bunch of veterinarians. What do you call a bunch of veterinarians? Gaggle or something? Anyhow, Tom Gill, Lisa Fortier, Sarah Meixel, and Alfonso Torres. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We talked a little bit about how difficult the life of a vet is versus an MD. How do you become a vet? You know, what should someone in the audience who wants to become a vet do?
Well, I'll tell you, obviously it starts with a love of animals. It's just something that I think animals play a big role in all of our lives, and if you find that you're a person who really, really loves animals, then veterinary medicine may be for you. But if you're in, you know, junior high and high school, you've got to remember that this is a very science-oriented kind of career, and you got to get those good grades in those science courses. When you get to the college level, you have to have a 4-year degree. You don't necessarily have to be a science major. You can be an English major and still be a veterinarian, but you do have to take a course load of specific courses. One thing I will say, even though it is a career that's all about animals, you got to remember that Fluffy does not drive herself to the vet's office, and Flicka does not call us out when she's got a bellyache. So it is a service profession that's very, very reliant on owners, clients, and so if you're not a people person, I don't think you can run away from people by becoming a veterinarian, because you do have to deal with folks.
And if you're going to set up your own business, you've got to be a business person too, don't you, Sarah Mike?
That's absolutely true. Business background is something that we don't get in vet school at all, and it's something that is really missing when you get out in the real world.
Let's go to the audience. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Derek Calhoun, and I'm actually one of the 15 men to sneak into vet school in my class. I'm in the fourth year. And as a veterinarian, I'm hoping primarily to promote the human-animal bond through a combination of clinical practice, education, advocacy, and policy, and hopefully build on my sociology background. I was wondering about the panel's thoughts on the social impact of animals.
Is he dreaming? Is he going to have enough time to do all these things if he's a vet? You know, I wish you well. Don't take that wrong. But when I hear what Tom and Sarah and Lisa are talking about being a vet and how much time it takes. But in all seriousness, any reaction to Dr. Meixel?
The human-animal bond is incredible. And I see people coming in who truly believe that these animals, truly feel that these animals they're bringing in are family members. They are family members. They sleep in their beds every night. Mm-hmm. They're with them all day. They're inside. They're protected when they go out. They're treating them as family members. And when they lose a pet, it's losing a family member.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Viola in Shawnee, Wisconsin. Hi, Viola.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you today?
Fine.
I have comment about my veterinarian. She's from Gillett, and I extra drive there just to take my dog there. She gets her back thrown out once in a while, and she's also a chiropractor, and she does acupuncture. She recently went to China to get more experience in acupuncture, more studies. And I'm wondering if they could comment on that.
Good point. Thanks for calling, and good luck with your acupuncture. What do you say, Sarah? Is acupuncture on the list of most vets these days?
It certainly is on a list of things that we do for pets as well as horses, and chiropractics as well. Yes, just like in human medicine, it's an ancillary thing that we do.
Okay, let's see if we can go over here. Yes, sir.
Hi, Mark Deutschlander, Hobart and Williamson Colleges.
I'm back. Can't get rid of it.
This is not about birds. I'm actually the pre-health advisor as well, and I have a lot of students coming in who want to go on to vet school, so it's good to hear there's jobs out there for them. And you talked a little bit about what they need to do. Knowing what you know now, what would you tell those students in terms of what to do while they're in college? They have to do well academically, but what else would you give those students in terms of advice?
You know,
they'd have to really love what they're going to be doing, right?
I think that you do have to spend some time volunteering at a vet clinic or on a farm or getting some kind of experience with animals. I mean, I would definitely advocate one of the problems we don't have food animal vets is because there are not a lot of kids coming from farms anymore. And so a lot of kids from the city feel that they are not qualified, they haven't had enough life experiences in those species. I'm here to tell you that you can be raised in the heart of New York City and be a heck of a dairy vet if you'd like to be. You just have to go out and get some experience. So getting some experience either working with animals or with veterinary clinics is a good thing. Again, I really, really, truly feel that this is a people business, and getting experience working with people is a good thing. I think that that's very important.
Thanks for the question. Before I go to a question from the audience, I want to just probe a little bit more with Dr. Fortier about her equine stem cell line. You are trying to establish an equine line of stem cells, is that correct?
We have several lines of stem cells. We have embryonal stem cells, so derived from day 8 embryos. Mm-hmm. We also have many lines of adult-derived stem cells, so you can get stem cells from your bone marrow. You can get it from your fat or adipose tissue. You can get it from muscle as well. And one of the goals of our laboratory is to try to determine which stem cell is best. Perhaps a stem cell from your bone marrow is best to treat your tendon, but maybe an embryonal stem cell is best to treat your cartilage.
Is that right? So you're just trying to figure out which ones work?
Correct.
For what kind of ailments. Sarah, could you use that in your practice if she comes up with something like that?
Sure. Yeah. We have a lot of bone and joint diseases in animals as well, in small animals as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over here to this microphone. Hi.
Could you tell me in your experiences what the most challenging surgery was and how solve it? So could you tell me that?
What was the most challenging surgery you ever had? And how did you solve it? I think there's a TV show here. I really, some producer is going to come and watch you guys do this sort of thing. Dr. Fortier, you want to?
The most challenging surgeries are those that are associated with a lot of bleeding, because you can't see where the bleeding's coming from or stopping it. It's hard to control your own reaction to the panic mode of, I'm losing this patient. Why can't I stop the bleeding? And then somebody else is like, it's bleeding. I know that. and on top of it, if you're not 100% comfortable with the anatomy, for example, when we started to operate llamas and alpacas a few years ago, they may or may not have exact intestinal architecture of a cow that we operate all the time. So if you get into a very difficult situation in a species that maybe you only operate once a week, that makes it even more challenging, but bleeding is the most challenging part.
Do you do any bird surgery, Tom or Lisa? Mm-hmm. Say? No? Let's get our bird folks back again.
I've done surgery on a couple of chickens.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You save a chicken?
Yeah, sure.
It must be a very loved chicken.
It is, yes.
It's a loved chicken. Mm-hmm. It's not going in anybody's pot.
No.
And what was the surgery that you did on a chicken?
Opening up a part of their intestinal tract to remove some stones and woody debris that they'd gotten in there, some shavings. Mm-hmm. It was blocking them.
So it was a pet, it must have been.
Yeah.
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 Cornell has a very specific oriented wildlife clinic. So because of all the things you heard in the previous panel about how to handle these animals, deer and all the other wildlife species go to the wildlife clinic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to, thank you for that question, this side of the audience.
Chris Dietrich, Ithaca, New York. Back in Michigan, I have several friends who breed pet rats, and I've often heard them lament that the baseline for establishing health for rats was set with laboratory rats rather than pet rats in the different populations. And I was wondering if there are any other species or types of animal where there's a problem that the baseline was set with a different type of animal.
I think that's true of all the little pocket pets, gerbils, hamsters, rats, rabbits. I think that the baseline for all of those have been set with laboratory animals. But the more people keep them as pets, the more we'll at least have personal experience with baseline on those animals.
Do you have trouble with people letting go of their pet if it's way beyond anything?
Sure.
That must be very difficult
for
you as the doctor.
Well, yes, but what's important is to give them counsel on what they're doing and what's happening. And a lot of times they look to you to tell them when it's time.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard for them to do that.
Yeah. Same with a horse, too.
Very much.
Yeah. Especially an expensive horse.
And sometimes you just can't fix it. We don't have the mechanical plates. We don't have the equipment to fix it. So even if you had all the money in the world, Barbaro, you can't fix him.
Yeah, that's sad. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's William of Binghamton High School. With the surge of pet owners being so attached to their pets and the move to organic and natural healing, what is veterinary medication doing along the lines of acupuncture or natural remedies?
No, we hear a little bit about acupuncture. What about natural, homeopathic or natural remedy?
All of those things are becoming much more popular, and you will find veterinarians in practice whose specialty is homeopathic medicine and the adjunct of things like chiropractics and acupuncture.
Can the animal tell you it's getting better from these medicines?
Well, they can tell you by how they're acting and how they're feeling.
But you're not satisfying the owner more than the pet by doing these
things. No, you're helping the pet.
You're helping the pet.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
Hi, I'm wondering if there are certain foods that are bad for cats like there are for dogs.
Certainly. And
chocolate? Is chocolate bad for cats?
Yes, it's bad for cats and dogs. And onions and garlic are particularly bad for cats as well. Cats are carnivores, and they have to eat mainly meat. And it's important to remember that when you're feeding your pet. And with cats and dogs, the most important thing is to remember that the pet food companies put a lot of research into making their foods the best they can be for that particular animal. And that's why you should choose those foods as their main source of food.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yes, Lisa, you alluded to this earlier, but I was wondering, the people who go to veterinary school, what proportion of them are interested in treating wild animals, maybe in the field of ecology or conservation?
It's certainly on the rise. I think it used to be, when the veterinary college was established, it was mostly food animal, and then it shifted to small animal, with very, very few people interested in public policy or wildlife health or aquatics as well. And I'm going to say about a quarter of our applicants now have a strong interest. I'm looking down at our dean, looking for a nod of, yes, you're close to right. About a quarter of our applicants are very interested in what we used to consider minority aquatics, public health, and wildlife as well.
Let me get to Dr. Torres' answer to that, but let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato at Cornell University. Going to ask Dr. Alfonso Torres to comment on that.
One of the challenges that we have when we deal with wildlife diseases is that they are happening in a certain ecosystem. So we are not only trying to understand the disease in the animal itself, in which we have to extrapolate from experience from all the species with the problems that that had, but also we need to understand the ecology that is causing that problem in that group of wildlife. So we need to work a lot with a lot of other professionals from sociologists, anthropologists, ecologists, and the like.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I'm Steve Tamash. Some time ago, I found a hatchling. It was obviously a wild bird, fell out of a nest. I took it to Cornell, and they accepted it from me. When I called following up what happened to it, they told me that they turned it over to the nuisance animal wildlife section. Can you elaborate on what this concept about nuisance wildlife?
Is there such a thing as nuisance wildlife? No? I don't know. We'll have to take that up with them. We can't figure that out. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
You talked earlier about people want quality pet care for their domesticated animals. How does somebody go about determining who's the best vet for them?
How do you pick a vet?
I always tell people when they're moving and they ask me if I know anyone in the city they're moving to talk to their coworkers, to their neighbors, people who have pets and clearly take good care of their pets, is get to get references for veterinarians. And beyond that, I believe the most important thing is to have a good rapport with your veterinarian to be able to communicate with them. Okay. It's important that you feel comfortable when you go. They're very much the same as when you choose your own doctor. You need to feel comfortable and feel that you're being listened to because you're the voice for your pet.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the internet now has a lot of resources on it for mm-hmm. finding vets around the
yes.
around new places in the country. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Chris.
Well, we'll get there.
We'll get there? Oh, there we are. Yeah. I'm Chris. I'm from Ithaca, New York, and I'm just wondering if we got a fish, goldfish, and it's charming, but it's got a little bump on its head. Everybody comes over and they say, oh, you can just take it up to Cornell. They're wizards. You know, they can do anything. Can you guys really operate on a fish?
Can you operate on a goldfish?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir? Tell us about it.
I.
She's waiting. Go to her. Go to her clinic, you know. Go to Small Animal, you know, Veterinary Care of Ithaca. She's at.
Yeah. I have never operated on a fish, but there are koi fish that are extremely expensive fish, and I know they have all sorts of medicine to treat those guys.
There you go. And just because it has one of these bumps doesn't mean it's sick. Some of these koi look very unusual.
They do.
All right. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. It was our pleasure to be here. Tom Gill is a large animal veterinarian and owner of the Brookside Veterinary Clinic in Auburn, New York. Thank you, Tom, for being here.
My pleasure.
Lisa Fortier is president of the International Cartilage Repair Society and associate professor of large animal surgery at Cornell. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Fortier. Sarah Meixel is a small animal veterinarian, owner of Veterinary Care of Ithaca.
Thank you.
Be working on those fish pretty soon. There. And Alfonso Torres is associate dean for public policy at Cornell University. And I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
A lot of folks to thank. We could not have made this trip to Ithaca without thanking folks. Let's start out with Greg Smith, who composed our theme music today. Also, to Visit Ithaca, we want to thank them. Warren Allman and the staff of the Museum of the Earth. If you have this resource here in town, and the Museum of the Earth is a great little museum. You should all take a visit to. We were over there yesterday. I'd like to thank Aaron Reed and Greg Cotterill and the WEOS team for making this visit possible. Also, thank... Yeah, go ahead. Thanks. That's our public radio station here. Very happy. Also want to thank Linda McCoola and Blaine Friedlander at Cornell, David Page, David Kingsley, and Bill Estee at Bailey Hall. Thank you all for taking us in and giving us such great hospitality here at Bailey Hall. Great, great auditorium. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging. If you missed any of the show today, we'll be up there in a podcast. Also, Science Friday's video pick of the week. Flora has that visit out there. If you want to go watch them tagging those birds, it's quite interesting. And also, we're Twittering all week long. If you want to get in on the tweeting and the Twittering, we're happy for you to see that. Also have a whole catalog of videos up there besides the one we have this week. Thank you for your hospitality here in Bailey Hall. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in Ithaca.